Shyam here. Who just joined us?
Charlie,
great. We have quorum.
Good.
And as long as Paul and Dave Collins and Foreman Williams are still here, we have a quorum. Paul, since you have a quorum, I would suggest you start, and then we'll follow an agenda.
I agree with you, Shyam, and with that, I will call the meeting to order. Just so that, and for the record, I would just like to go around with the individual committee members so they can identify themselves and we know who's here. I'm Paul Fitzgerald. I'm the chair of the committee. I believe we'll go in the order of people signing in after me. I think Foreman was next.
Foreman Williams, committee member from the University of California, San Diego.
Thank you, Foreman. Dave?
Dave Collins, representing the American Institute of Architects.
Thank you, Dave. And? Who? Charlie?
Charlie Thornton.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Shyam, would you please allow your staff to introduce themselves?
Excuse me. We'll start the NIST introductions. This is Shyam Sundar here. I'm the lead investigator for the World Trade Center investigation.
Melissa Lieberman, Deputy Chief Counsel for NIST.
Terry McAllister, research engineer and investigator on World Trade Center 7.
John Gross, research engineer, NISD.
Matt Heyman, chief of staff, NIST.
Bill Gross-Sandler, associate leader of the investigation at NIST.
Fahim Sadek, a member of the structures group at NIST.
Michael Newman, NIST Public Affairs.
Steve Kaufman, BFRL, NIST, and program manager for the investigation.
Dick
Gannon. Okay, Paul, we're done here.
Fine. Thank you very much, everyone.
And Bud Nelson, too.
I beg your pardon? Bud. Welcome, Bud. It's been a while since we've talked.
You've probably been too busy with football.
We'll talk about that separately. You have an agenda that was distributed prior to the meeting. Are there any additions, modifications, or changes a committee member would like to make? Hearing none, then we will start with the agenda itself. For the benefit of the committee members, you will note that the committee meeting is scheduled to run until 2:25 this afternoon, at which point there will be a five-minute break to allow public comments to call in and participate in the latter part of the meeting. There are three, as it stands right now, we anticipate that there will be three speakers. Mr. Richard Gage, who represents the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Mr. James Gurley. Mr. Gurley is an attorney who represents several scientists, including Mr. Gage, and 9/11 victims' families. And Mr. Jerry Liepart, another attorney who you recall participated in last year's meeting. So we will take a five-minute break at 2:25. If we finish a little earlier than 2:25, then it might be a little longer break, but I would like certainly all the committee members to come back at 2:30 so that we can listen to the comments that guests may wish to make. I have no other opening remarks to make, and so with that, I suggest we get on to the formal part of the agenda, and that starts with Shyam, who will give us an overview of the WTC investigation. Shyam, the floor is yours.
Paul?
Yes.
This is Dave Collins.
Yes, David.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch everything that you said about who Richard Gage represents.
Richard Gage represents a group known as the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? With that, Shyam, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Paul. I want to just take a few minutes to update you on where we are in the overall investigation. Obviously, we released a report on the towers in October of 2005, and we had a series of recommendations from it. But beyond that, you know, we've done some work on 7 as well, so I'm going to say a little bit about that and some schedules. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview of where we are. Of the 30 recommendations that we made, the private sector organizations, basically the standards and codes and industry organizations, have been working very hard over the last 3 years trying to understand, interpret, digest, and internalize the recommendations in terms of improvements to standards and codes and industry practices. And as a major event that took place this past May was the adoption by the International International Code Council, which actually issues the International Building Code, which is a model building code used throughout the 50 states of the United States, of a number of changes, 8 specific changes to the to their building code based on our recommendations. Of course, the process that the International Code Council uses is a very, very thorough process, which includes the submission of code change proposals by the private sector. Those were actually written by various committees of the International Code Council and by other private sector entities working through the National Institute of Building Sciences, not NIST. And through the technical committee process and then through the final hearing process, all of the members of the international government, members of the International Code Council that represents the state and local building officials in the nation, voted in majority to adopt those changes. We issued a press release sometime in June, and the details of those changes are documented in the press release, so I won't go through each one of the changes, but they are very substantial changes in the manner of evacuation or egress of a building, in the manner of fire protecting a building in terms of ensuring the integrity of the fire protection as well as the structural frame. There are a number of additional code changes that are being considered as well. In addition to what's happening in the International Code Council, there are several organizations such as the National Fire Protection Association, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, ASTM International, the American Society of Civil Engineers, and the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat that also are actively considering either developing or improving their standards and code provisions and guidelines based on the NIST recommendations. So we are working as we had promised 2 years ago. We are working hard with all of these organizations so that we can provide the technical assistance to them through their voluntary processes that are in place. In addition to what's already happened, there are additional, somewhere on the order of 47 code change proposals that have been submitted to the 2009 edition of the International Building Code. The edition that I talked about where approvals were made last summer was the 2007 supplement to the International Building Code. For the 2009 edition, there are 47 code change proposals. Some of them are new and consistent with our recommendations. Some of them are editorial in nature, trying to improve what's already been approved, and some of them try to make changes to what's been approved, but there are a very large number of them that are new, which include provisions for progressive collapse mitigation, which include provision, which was, in fact, two proposals, one that was put together by the industry themselves, which I think has a great chance of being adopted, and also proposals for the inclusion of occupant evacuation elevators in high-rise buildings, which too seem to have the strong support of the International Code Council's Code Technology Committee, which is kind of an important group within that ICC body that endorses proposals that are submitted. So we see a very positive movement on the part of the private sector based on our recommendations. These are hard decisions for the private sector because there are very different interests and perspectives, but they are working very diligently, and we're hoping at the end of the day the answers, the changes that are adopted will actually help in the safety of high-rise building in the United States. On a separate topic, a year ago in August of 2006, NIST released a set of frequently asked questions, answers to a set of frequently asked questions. We released that because there were a number of questions that were being asked about the collapse of the World Trade Center towers and the findings of our investigation related to the towers. That comprehensive list has stood us in good stead, but subsequent to the release of that list, there have been more questions asked, you know, in terms of our findings and our conclusions and so forth. And we find that in many, many situations, there's not a full appreciation of the work we had done. So we decided to release a supplementary list of such frequently asked questions, the responses to frequently asked questions. And that supplementary list was posted, I believe, just this past Friday. So if you look at our website, the World Trade Center website, there is now a second list of supplementary answers to FAQs, and those are hopefully will put to rest the questions that are in play over the past 6 to 8 months. Now let me move quickly to the World Trade Center 7 investigation. We started this investigation in parallel with the original tower investigation. It was an element of our overall investigation, but at a point in time in 2004, summer of 2004, after we released a progress report in June, we decided to stop work on 7 and focus all our resources, staff resources, on World Trade Center towers, because that was a very, very challenging analysis that we had to work on. And so after the release of the towers report in October of 2005, we then began initiated the work on World Trade Center 7, and essentially what we have done is we had to compete the contracts, reassess the scope of work, and issue a new set of statements of work, a new set of contractors were selected. They were in place by the middle of 2006. We also had to review a very, very large number of boxes of evidence, boxes of information, I guess, 80 boxes of information. And as we went through that process and started to build these models, so where we are at now is what Terry is going to provide you a detailed overview with, and I'm going to let her do that. But what I do want to remind you is our working hypothesis that we are using for the collapse of World Trade Center 7. First of all, I want to say this is a working hypothesis, which means the hypothesis has not yet been tested based on the analysis, and therefore these are not a leading hypothesis. The leading hypothesis will be formulated when our analysis is complete. This work is based on preliminary analysis that we have done. It is based on simple models that we have built, and it's based on engineering judgment. And that's what a working collapse hypothesis means. The working collapse hypothesis for 7 was actually released in June of 2004. And if you look at the slide, the second slide in my presentation or the third slide in my presentation, the first three bullets under the sub-bullets under the first bullet define what was in the June 2004 progress report. Nothing has changed. We're still dealing with the same working collapse hypothesis. It has three steps: an initial local failure, which occurred at the lower floors below floor 13 of the building, and that occurred due to fire and or debris-induced structural damage of a critical column, which we call the initiating event. And that particular column supported a pretty large span floor bay with an area of about 2,000 square feet, which is kind of unusual in buildings. The second step is a vertical progression of that initial local failure, which occurred all the way up to the east penthouse, that is from below floor 13 all the way up. It progressed all the way up to the east penthouse. And as the large floor bays became unstable, unable to redistribute the loads, it brought down the interior structure below the east penthouse. The third step of that is triggered by this damage due to the vertical failure. There's a horizontal progression of the failure across the lower floors. In the region of floors 5 and 7 that were much thicker and more heavily reinforced than the rest of the floors. And that horizontal progression resulted then in the disproportionate collapse of the structure. So all three events, the initial failure, the vertical progression, followed by the horizontal progression, led then to the overall collapse of the structure. So that is what we had said in 2004. That is still our current working hypothesis. We do have a little bit more detail on this particular working hypothesis than we had before. It still is it's the first step where we talked about the initial local failure. We now have a better feeling for what the initiating event sequence should be that leads to that initial local failure. And it's based on fire-induced failures initiating in the tenant floors. And the tenant floors basically are floors above.
Which floors?
Tenant floors are above 7, right?
Above floors 8, 14 is where the.
Yeah, no. Where are the tenant floors? 5 is not a tenant floor,
right? They start at floor 8 and go
floor,
to 47.
Yeah, 8 through 47 are the tenant floors. So, the three steps of this initiating event sequence are first point that we make is that floor beams, slabs, and connections heat more quickly and to higher temperatures than the columns for the same fire. That's the first observation. The second observation is that the elevated temperatures in the floor elements lead to thermal expansion, sagging, and weakening that result in failure of the floor connections and or buckling of the floor beams. So that's the second point to make. And the third and final point to make is that when sufficient floor component failures happen, either in connections and or beams, that results in at least one long unsupported column because of the failure of the floor components at the lower floors, which then leads to the initiation of global collapse. So that's really the sequence of events that leads to that initial local failure of a column below floor 13. I have to again stress, this is a working hypothesis. Now, three other points are worth making. While we have found, still have found, what we said when we released our frequently answered questions in 2006 was, we had found no evidence of a blast or controlled demolition event, and that we were evaluating the magnitude of hypothetical blast scenarios that could have led to the structural failure of one or more critical elements. That statement still applies today. We have found no evidence of a blast or controlled demolition event, but we continue to evaluate the magnitude of hypothetical blast scenarios that could have led to the structural failure of one or more critical elements. The working hypothesis that we have now is based on an initial local failure that is caused by normal building fires. These are not fires from leaking pressurized fuel lines or from fuel fires due to fuel in the day tanks that were in the buildings. So there is a little bit of this hypothesis is a little bit more refined than what we had before where we did not make a statement on what we thought was the what were the fires that were actually being involved in the process. And finally, of course, we have to caveat this by saying this hypothesis may be modified or supported, or new hypothesis may be developed over the course of the investigation. And as we did for the towers, we will have, this is a working hypothesis. When our analysis is complete, we lead to a leading hypothesis, and when our leading hypothesis, when we write our report, the leading hypothesis then becomes a probable collapse sequence. So those are three steps in our process. So I just want you to know this is step one. Let me now very quickly turn to the overall schedule for the project, and Terry will go through many of the factors that are being considered, and will be able to explain to you, you know, the time that is taken for us to get where we are, and the time it's going to take us to get to where we want to be.
Tom?
Yes.
Dave Collins.
Yeah.
You made a statement that the initial local failure was caused by normal building fires. What do you mean by normal building fires?
What we mean by normal building fires is building fires in spaces where the combustible was the normal building and the ventilation was the normal building ventilation, and the and there were no other kinds of combustibles, such as in this particular case, fuel. You know, the fuel that was in the for the from the day tanks on the every floor, and the fuel in the large tanks at the bottom of the building that were actually powering the power generators in the buildings. So in this particular case, that's what we mean. In the case of the towers, of course, the jet fuel was the unique source of fuel. But there again, we talked about normal building fires that played a role, which is the jet fuel was burnt within a matter of a few minutes. What burned over the next few hours or hour and a half was really fires that were where the combustible was really was typically the normal building contents plus the airplane contents.
But they were ventilated fires.
In the case of the towers, there was a lot of in both cases the ventilation probably was somewhat limited. You know, in the case of the towers, the windows continued to break, and therefore the oxygen continued to be supplied. In the case of seven, of course, you know, we have information on window breakage, but it's not as detailed as we would, you know, we had it in the case of the towers.
Thank you.
Okay. In terms of the overall schedule, our hope is that the analysis, you know, there are two kinds of analysis we're doing. One is the detailed thermal analysis using ANSYS, which gives you the initiating event sequence. The second one is a global analysis, which includes the vertical and horizontal progression of failures, or those steps of the process, once the initiating event is specified, and that is using LS-DYNA. And at this point, the analysis of the initiating event we expect will be completed in January of 2008, which is about a month and a half from now. We expect to finish the global analysis to the initiating event by March, and at that stage we will then identify a leading collapse hypothesis, which will then lead to the drafting of our reports for internal review by the technical team, followed by a revised draft that is shared with the advisory committee, that's you folks, as well as reviewed at NIST. We have a normal NIST quality control for all publications released by NIST. It's called the editorial review board at NIST, and all publications before they're released by NIST are reviewed by that independent body. And that review will be done, and that will be done concurrently with the advisory committee review sometime in June, and we expect to release the draft reports for public comment at that soon after that in July, and there will be a period of public comment similar to what we have for the towers, at the end of which we will then release the final reports. So that is really the overall schedule. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. If there are none, then we'll just move to Terry's presentation.
Sean, this is Paul. What will be the magnitude of the final report we're talking about? Is it going to be sizable amount of documentation like we had for the towers?
Well, in the case of the towers, we had something like 10,000 pages. My guess in this case is going to be 1,000 pages or less, probably on the order of a little bit less than that, so maybe half, you know, could be half that, could be as much as 1,000 pages. And so, probably be on the order of, we're trying to keep it to three reports. We still haven't fully finalized whether whether we want separate volumes or appendices in some cases, and so we're still struggling with that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, Terry, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Sean. I'm going to go over the technical approach and the status of our investigation since we reported to you last December. And let me start by going to slides. I think my slides are numbered in the bottom left-hand corner, bottom right-hand corner, with restating what the objectives are in the WTC-7 investigation. Of course, it's determine why and how WTC-7 collapsed, determine what procedures and practices were used in the design, construction, operation, and maintenance of 7, and doing a very thorough investigation of these procedures and practices was very important to our understanding of how the building performed. After we're done with the first two bullets, we want to identify as specifically as possible areas in current building and fire codes that warrant revision. This would be something similar to the recommendations that were made after the towers work. If our findings warrant any additional recommendations, we will identify those and include them in our report. And again, slide 3 is going over the overall investigation approach. We had 4 primary steps, obtaining information on the building construction and content, as well as identifying the condition of the building on 9/11 following the events related to the towers, including damage, fires, and the sequence of collapse that were observed. And this information was obtained from available evidence, witness accounts, photos, and videos. We have an extensive collection of documents. We do not have as many photos and videos for WTC-7 as we had for the towers. The second major step was to identify possible initiating event scenarios, including the location and type of local failures that could have led to the collapse as it was observed based on the photos and videos from the exterior views of the building. And as part of that, we've considered fire events, both those that were observed and some hypothetical events, and hypothetical blast events. And the third step then was to develop a series of models, fire, thermal, and structural models, so we could conduct analyses of the sequence of events that occurred, including the possible initiation mechanisms. We had to consider how the fire grew and spread, how the heat transferred to the structure, and how the sequence of failure events at the component level led to what was observed for global collapse. And given the input of the previous 3 steps, we are looking to determine the probable collapse sequence that led to the events as they were observed on 9/11. Yeah, you've seen this graphic on slide 4 before. This is intended to give you an idea of the interdependency of the analyses that we are conducting. If you start as part of the understanding the condition of the building, we evaluated damage due to debris impact from the collapsing towers, and that provided input to three of our analyses, the fire dynamics analysis, which generated gas temperature histories. That was an input to the thermal analysis, which also required information on the fireproofing damage that occurred following the debris impact. And that provided a series of structural temperature histories for use in the structural response to the damage and the fires. Now, for the modeling of the structural response, as Sean mentioned, we have two analyses. The first part of the analysis, using ANSYS, is looking at the structural response to the fires in the lower floors between floors 7 to 14, where fires were observed, and creating an understanding through modeling the response of the structure to these three temperature histories of what the possible initiating events were that were not visible from the outside of the building, but led to the series of events resulting in the global collapse. And part of that is also considering fire events and blast events, which we have been doing, and trying to understand what the initiating events would be for the LS-DYNA analysis. The LS-DYNA has a model from the ground up to the penthouse and the entire 47-story structure, and it takes as an input results from the ANSYS analysis between floors 7 to 14, as well as the damage that occurred from the debris impact.
Goodbye.
And it is intended to use the initiating event, allow the failures to propagate, and determine as best we can which initiating event that is input will best reflect the sequence of events that led to global collapse as were observed.
Is everybody still on the line? We just want to make sure that we didn't lose anyone.
Jolly's here.
Okay.
Bob Hansen is here.
All right.
Herman Williams is here.
Paul?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. We just heard a goodbye. And Dave, are you still on?
I am.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Sorry, Terry.
Okay. Now, there were some significant factors or events during the last year that we think are worthy of mentioning. We had an additional 80 boxes of documents that reflected the modifications made to WTC-7. This was the tenants that came into the building after the original building construction, and it also included inspection reports of the construction. Additionally, as Sean described, we elaborated the initiating event sequence for the collapse hypothesis, and this required adding possible failure mechanisms to both our ANSYS and our LS-DYNA analyses. And this led to extensive analysis at the component and connection level to make sure that we understood the mechanisms and that they were adequately captured in both of the finite element analyses. We acquired shop drawings of the connections. This was a substantial number of drawings. It gave us the details of all the connections in World Trade Center 7. And, of course, this led to extensive revisions of connection details in both the ANSYS and LS-DYNA finite element models. Given the events outlined in especially items 2 and 3 here, this led to significant time to develop, debug, enhance the efficiency of, verify, and validate these models. To make sure that with these additions that they were still functioning as we expected them to for both the thermal and the structural response of WTC-7. Now, Sean has already covered the working collapse hypothesis, but what I want to emphasize is that this initiating event sequence capturing the possible initiating event sequences that could have led to global collapse required a number of improvements that I want to specify a bit more to the structural model. And I do want to emphasize that NIST has gone to a great deal of care to take a highly rigorous approach to capturing these failure mechanisms that were identified. And the level of analysis we're conducting with both ANSYS and LS-DYNA is, we believe, advancing the state of art in computational analysis. The significant improvements that we've made to the models focused around capturing failures in the connections, the beams, and the columns. If you look at the first bullet, we identified incorporated failure mechanisms. The first sub-bullet is related to connections. All the possible failure mechanisms in the connections in WTC7 are listed there, and they were all started with the shop drawings, hand calculations, component models, and finally incorporation in the larger 16 and 47 story models in ANSYS and LS-DYNA respectively. And of course, we also had to take a look at lateral torsional buckling behavior of the beams and buckling of columns in the global analyses. As part of doing that, 18 types of user-defined break elements for the ANSYS model were incorporated between floors 8 to 14, and 31 types of connection submodels for the LS-DYNA model. And let me just explain that the ANSYS model primarily uses beam elements for the framing and shell elements for the slab. The LS-DYNA model uses primarily shell elements for both the beams and the slab. And so the modeling techniques and the names here are a little bit different, reflecting the details of those two types of models. But the basic idea is the same in terms of capturing the behavior of these failure mechanisms in both types of analyses. So each break element then in ANSYS containing multiple failure mechanisms, which were modeled using beam elements, contact elements, nonlinear springs, and rigid links, because we had also a three sets of shear connections for beam-to-beam framing, seven types of bearing connections for girders framing into columns, and then we had shear stud connections between the steel beams and the slab. And just to give you an idea of the extent of the modifications that were made, a total of 12,900 elements were added to the ANSYS model to capture these behaviors in the connections in the beams, and 13,900 connection submodels were added to the LS-DYNA model, basically for all the beams and girders from floor 4 to the roof. The addition of these connection and failure mechanisms greatly increased the computational demand, and we found that it slowed the analysis when a large number of these failure break elements began to fail. So there has also been some time spent looking at the level of detail in the models and optimizing it to maintain modeling fidelity while capturing the failure mechanisms and minimizing computational times as best we can. This is a brief kind of highlight summary of what we have accomplished since last December. We have elaborated the initiating event sequences we've discussed. We reviewed the Manhattan dispatch tape for much of the day of September 11th. We completed the FDS analyses of fires on floors 7 through 13 that were observed. And this was based, similar as was done in the towers, on photos and videos and known information about the floor layouts and their contents. We completed the thermal analysis for transferring FDS gas temperature results to structural elements in the structural analysis for two of the three possible cases for both LS-DYNA and ANSYS. The three possible fire cases are based on the FDS results, which give us gas temperatures, and they include the the FDS results and then either a plus or minus 10% adjustment to the gas temperatures. And this has created our three cases, which we have labeled here as A, B, and C.
I just want to say that those plus and minus 10% are within, they are both represent, they're realistic representations of the fire, and they are reasonable representations of the fire.
A very good point. We had a lot of discussion to make sure that this was within the bounds of what could be expected to occur in the buildings, given the observations we had and the information we had. We have completed analysis of hypothetical blast events. We've completed analysis of fifth floor fire scenarios. And the addition of the possible failure mechanisms due to the initiating event that was identified required extensive analysis at component and connection levels to make sure these mechanisms were adequately captured. And as we just discussed, incorporating the connection data into both models has also been completed. Structural analysis of the initiating event for two of the three possible thermal cases is nearing completion, and structural analysis of vertical and horizontal progression of failure is in progress. So the remaining items that we have, and this, I think, helps explain the schedule that Sean presented, is we are completing the initiating event analyses. Case A and B are well underway, and C will be started shortly. So we'll complete those and identify initiating events based upon those results. After we complete these analyses and identify initiating events, we have to transfer the data from ANSYS to LS-DYNA. And this includes the temperature files, at the time that the initiating event is identified, as well as a list of all the damaged and failed connections and components from the analysis, ANSYS analysis. We then run the LS-DYNA 47-story building analysis for each identified initiating event. And they're numbered here as 1 and 2 because it could be, for instance, that two of our thermal cases give similar structural response, and so we don't want to necessarily make a one-to-one link between the thermal cases and the initiating events. Based upon those results, we'll develop the probable collapse sequence and, of course, document our work and what we have found. And a number of these sections, based on the work that's been completed so far, have been drafted and are in various stages of review. That is all I have to present to you today. I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
I suggest for the committee members that we kind of do it in a roundabout way, and I'll just call each individual committee member's name at random, and if they have any questions, they can ask them. Let me start with you, Foreman. Do you have any questions of Terry or Sean?
I don't really have any specific question about what Terry was talking about here. I mean, they're moving along in the analyses, it seems to me. I just was wondering about some general feeling. I mean, I think it's a good idea to chase down these possible initiation scenarios. That's good. That's going along. The fires were initiated, and then they continued to burn, I guess, for most of the day before the building finally came down. And so there was no firefighting efforts, of course, during that period within the building. So what's the general feeling? If fires are started in the building and there are no of that type, and there are no firefighting efforts, is it to be expected that eventually the building will come down? Is that the ordinary situation,
Or is the ordinary situation that the building would remain standing after the fires have burnt out? Could Sharon or
yeah,
somebody comment on that?
I will take a crack at this because I will take it in the broader context of how we design buildings for fire today, which is really this E119 test method, which is we subject components of a structure of a building. In fact, they're not only structural components, but they can include partitions and so forth, to a prescribed standard idealized time temperature exposure, and then we come up with a rating, a 1 hour rating, 2 hour rating, 3 hour rating, and the assumption somehow is that the system as a whole will survive that. The implicit assumption in all of our fire testing is that when you do have a situation where the sprinklers don't function, that you would actually have burnout without collapse, and burnout of the building contents without collapse. Even though that's sort of an implicit assumption, there is nothing in the current procedures that are used in the building code that actually ensures that. And therefore, it is not surprising that different buildings will perform differently based on a fire, a normal building fire to which they're exposed. Obviously, buildings that are designed more conservatively, which would mean with a lot more partitions, with a lot more compartmentation, with much smaller spans, with more massive structural elements, with greater redundancy in the structural system, obviously will perform better than a structure that has very large open floor plans with very few fire compartments, preventing the spread of the fire, with few and far between columns, at fairly large, with large floor spans. In this particular case, we have floors of columns carrying 2,000 square feet of floor area. So, and maybe with less redundancy in the structural system, there will be differences in how those buildings perform. So it's not surprising. It shouldn't be surprising because we haven't really gotten the science to a point that we actually designed to meet this performance objective of burnout without collapse. In fact, that was a recommendation we made in the Towers report, if you remember, that and based on Phil Dineno's suggestion that we ought to say a target or objective should be to have burnout without collapse. In fact, that is a code change proposal that was submitted to the International Code Council this past cycle but was not approved, but is again being resubmitted. There are two proposals that address that particular requirement, and my sense is if we actually accomplish that, Foreman, the answer that you wanted will be, we would actually be enshrining or building in that answer to all buildings, not just the, case by case.
Well, a point that I guess I would make is that the time that the fires will burn must be influenced by the fuel loading. And so it's not just a question of building design, but it's also a question of building content. So it would seem to me that perhaps if the objective is to design a building so that they would burn out without collapsing, then there perhaps also would need to be some restrictions on the amount of fuel loading that could be put into the building after it's constructed. Has thought been given to that?
Yes, we are thinking about that, obviously, Foreman. I will point out one thing. We have to be careful because fuel loading by itself or combustible loading by itself doesn't tell the whole story. In the case of the towers, if you remember, you know, the movement of the fires in Building 1 every 20 minutes, you know, was very consistent with a fire based on a 4 pounds per square feet of fuel load. As you probably will agree, many more older buildings, office buildings, have had 10 pounds per square feet of combustible materials. And in those particular cases, we had, you know, small span buildings, more massive columns and so forth, and greater redundancy. So I think we have to combine the fuel. And in this particular building, in the case of World Trade Center 7, the analysis of fires that we have done suggests, again, a fuel effective fuel loading of something on the order of 4 pounds per square feet. Again, it's not heavily loaded in terms of fuel loading. So I think we have to be look at that fuel loading in the context of everything else.
So I guess for WTC 7, then what you're saying is that 4 pounds per square feet is an assumption that comes perhaps closest to the programs, the calculations, agreeing with what's known about the observations, but. In fact, I guess there's considerable uncertainty in what the actual fuel loading was in the various floors in the building.
Right. The uncertainty definitely exists, and our analysis accounts for that in the sense that we think, you know, fuel loadings can be off by a couple of pounds. Bill, you want
to
add anything?
I just wanted to distinguish, this is Bill Grosschandler, to distinguish between the total amount of combustible or organic material on a floor and the fuel load as we're using it here. There may very well be reams of paper that are in metal file cabinets that, given enough time, may in fact eventually smolder and burn out. But over the time scales, so we're talking about accessible fuel in the furnishings and the finished materials over the matter of a half hour or an hour or so in which the fire would be present. So that may be why the number seems lower than what others might have said.
Yeah, in WTC 7, it may well have been hours.
Well, that's correct. But the rate at which the heat is being released will be obviously much less if you are restricting the amount of air that can get into, say, into a metal cabinet, for example.
I do want to add to this, Foreman, I think you recognize it as well in your comment that you just made, that we have information on the rate at which at least on several floors, the rate at which the fires actually spread from location to location. So that's a check on the effective, or as Bill calls it, accessible fuel load that was operated on that day.
Yeah, that certainly is true. But on the other hand, there could be residual burning that...
Yeah, absolutely. We don't disagree.
Okay, they're the only comments I had to make. Thanks.
Thank you, Foreman. Dave?
Thank you, Paul. I'll disagree with Sean a little bit about the assumption that buildings are going to remain standing at burnout. I think there are what are termed frangible buildings assumed within the structure of our building codes, and that's why we limit the heights and areas of certain types of occupancies so that we don't certain types of occupancies and certain types of structures so that we don't have a catastrophe associated with those kinds of events, that we can address the needs of the occupants should the structure eventually fail, and that's done within a reasonable amount of time. I think most of the code, codes, plural, as we have them today, assume there's going to be some measure of intervention for fire protection in a facility if it is going to remain viable. If that doesn't happen, then we have some evidence of some structures that have had burnout scenarios, but even some of them had intervention either by mechanical means or by fire department response to adjust what was happening within the structure. So I mean, we lose structures totally on a daily basis. Residences are a primary example of that kind of structure, and I don't think the codes are ever likely to mandate that we're going to have a complete burnout of those kinds of buildings without the failure of the structure. Specifically to questions, Terry, in your remarks on page 9, you talk about case A, B, and C, temperatures to be complete at 16-story analysis. And then in the next bullet, you talk about temperature files for 47-story model. Maybe you describe how the two are interconnected and why one's 16 and one's 47, but I missed it if you did.
Sure, Dave, I'd be glad to. ANSYS is used to try to determine possible initiating events based on the fire cases that have been developed. Now, FDS went through the analysis given our best information about the contents and the floor layouts, and I think we do have a fair understanding of what was on each of those floors where fires were observed, which were 7, 8, 9, 11, 12, and 13. And there's a few areas where we couldn't get information, but overall we had a good understanding of the layout and contents on those floors. And from that, we generated a fire moving around based on studies that Sean was discussing that gave a good match to progression of fire available from photos and videos on the east, west, and north faces. And that kind of provided our base analysis. And we looked at that and said, given the fact that there are uncertainties and the exact amount of fuel, some in the layout, the fact that something may have been happening farther inside the building that we couldn't see from the exterior, we decided to bound this fire by increasing the gas temperatures either by 10% or decreasing them by 10% to give us a good range of what likely temperatures were in the building over time. And that's where our A, B, and C came from. Now, the ANSYS model is focused on identifying what local failures occurred at the beams and at the floor level. And so we're focused on floors 7 to 14, so the model runs from the ground up to floor 16. We then take that information and input it to the LS Dyna model, which is from the ground to the penthouse, the full 47 stories, and use that initiating event as an initial condition. And LS Dyna is a dynamic analysis that it keeps track of mass and impacts and things that were done, for instance, for the aircraft impact analysis. So we will give it an initial condition and then let the analysis run and see if we can simulate what was observed with the vertical progression of failure and the horizontal progression of failure.
Just want to add, this ANSYS model that Terry mentioned, 16-story analysis, it's not just a 16-story truncated. It's a 16-story, the bottom 16-story is where the details are captured so we can actually account for the thermal effects and structural response. Beyond the 16 stories, the weight of the rest of the structure is included, which is so nothing is ignored in terms of the forces on that structure.
That's right. Did I answer your question, Dave?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Dave, anything else?
No, Paul, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Charlie?
Yeah, a couple of questions. How many of this group have seen Terry's 59-slide presentation on the structural side?
I have.
I know that Hansen and Barsom and I had our conference on the 10th. I was just curious whether everyone had seen.
I think we have, yeah.
Okay.
I haven't.
Who is that?
Dave Collins.
Yeah, I think you should take a look at it. It's a lot more detailed than what Terry just went through. Originally, I thought that the fires were initiated in 7 when the North Tower came down. Is that still true?
What we do know is that when the North Tower came down, and is that there were large pieces of structural debris of various kinds, including structural components from the tower, that actually fell on Building 7. What we also know is that when the South Tower fell, I think, maybe it's been a while, but there was some dust particles that went into the 7 building, and there was a fire alarm condition that was recorded but not heard because the fire alarm system in 7 was on test that morning. And of course, as most people in the fire world know, that there are many things that can cause ignition, because there are so many electrical outlets in a building and so many places where short circuits or other kinds of things can happen to ignite a fire. So it's not our objective to figure out when exactly the fires themselves were initiated, but in fact to follow the fires as they developed and progressed through the building. So, yeah, it's the collapse of the North Tower that may have initiated the fire, but there could be other factors as well at play.
Okay, and originally, in the 59 slide presentation, there is mention of the house tanks and the diesel fuel and the pressurized system. So, but I'm confused because you said it a minute ago that a 4 pound per square foot fire in the World Trade Center moved around every 20 minutes and essentially started and stopped within 20 minutes. So if you don't have fuel in 7 World Trade Center, how could fires have burned for as long as they had and taken out this major structure that had good fireproofing?
Well, first of all, the fires in building the towers didn't stop at the end of 20 minutes. It's moved from location to location. That means that if the fire front, flame front, was in a particular location, it took, at any given location, the combustibles took about 20 minutes to be consumed. And therefore, the fire front would then progress to other areas where there were combustibles available, and then, of course, it would want to have ventilation, and the ventilation came, or the air for this came, from the breakage of the windows. So you had the right conditions for the fire front to keep propagating through the building every 20 minutes. So, you know, it moved from location to location every 20 minutes, but it wasn't that the fire stopped at the end of 20 minutes. In the same vein, in the case of Building 7, there were fires on multiple floors that were recorded. And many of these floors, the fires moving from east to west or from west to east and then to the north from the southeast side, those fires were actually moving at a particular rate. And what the observations we have suggest that movement on those multiple floors, which is, I guess, floor 8 through 14, minus the floor 10, I think, were moving at that rate of about 20 minutes from location to location.
But maybe let me ask another question. How long does a 4 pound per square foot combustible office building fire generally last?
The rule of thumb for 10 pounds per square feet is 1 hour. 4 pounds is 20 minutes.
So again, why would these fires have burned for as long as they did in order to take out this rather well fireproofed, heavy, robust structure?
Charlie, what I'm saying, I'm not communicating well what I'm saying, which is that the fire at any one location is consumed in 20 minutes where the fire front is, but then it moves to the next place where there's more combustible.
But if you're saying that beams sagged and buckled and pulled, okay, that had to be exposed to the fire for more than 20 minutes.
It's the temperatures at which the beams are exposed that is the critical issue here, not how long they were exposed to that temperature. And, of course, beams and the slabs have any fireproofing, concrete slab. The metal deck may have some. The beams are much more slender elements in terms of thermal mass. And, of course, the fireproofing on the beams, the floor beams, are much less than the fireproofing on the girders and, of course, the columns. And so when you go through the analysis for these fires, which are moving around from location to location, on those particular floor beams, you see a considerable amount of temperature increases. In fact, you see temperatures getting up to, in certain regions, to 500-600 degrees. Now, what also compounds this is that you have these heating elements in very large spans. In the northeast side of the building, as we said before, there were 2,000 square feet large spans, floor areas that supported columns. So those spans were, in fact, sagging. And we're seeing evidence through our analysis of these fairly large magnitude of sag.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like between the words here, you're questioning the use of spray-on fireproofing for a two-hour rating on a W21 wide flange beam as an effective fireproofing in the absence of sprinkler systems.
Can I add two things, Sean? Charlie, this is Bill Grossdale, and there are a couple of things. You can have an ignition event quite early in the process in which the fire does not burn robustly but smolders and is, you know, barely maintained. And unlike the towers where you had so much fuel distributed in which the fire spread very quickly, you can have a fire ignited and not grow very fast. It reaches then a certain critical size, and then it begins moving, as Sean described. That's one thing. The second, so that could be literally a matter of an hour or two, where it could be burning in a very slow rate and then burst out into a full-fledged floor fire. The second thing is, don't forget that once the fire front passes, you still have a lot amount of heat there. So the cool-down period following the consumption of most of the fuel is still very, very hot. It's and will last for a couple hours. So that adds to the heating of the structure.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, Bill. The fire front moves, but the the heated elements don't cool down.
John, this is Bud. I ran down the same question as Charlie did some time ago.
Okay.
Same concerns. But the basic point is that this was a bank fire, and we did the temperature study by using the model, the fire dynamic simulator model, and the temperature, it was more like a series of burners coming on at 20-minute intervals, and as I said, pumping heat into the building, losing some through the vents, having others sink into the material. And the model gave the fire that they are using. You transferred all the temperatures on the back side of the fireproofing and then compared those to the properties of the steel or concrete, as the case may be, and fed into the structural model these changes in qualities.
Yeah, I think that is an important point that, Charlie, we aren't making any assumptions in this thing. The models are very detailed. So the fire dynamics model gives us the information on the gas temperatures. The thermal model, which is using also LS-DYNA, which is not the structural model, models the fireproofing thickness and the structural elements, the steel elements there. So based on the gas temperature, it's actually predicting the rise of the temperature in the steel through the fireproofing, and that is done with considerable detail. And then at that point, the structural model comes into play. So
yeah.
I think that's
I'm not questioning it. What you're doing, I'm questioning the way that American architects and structural engineers design buildings with spray-on proof, fireproofing. I think you're basically coming out with a conclusion that maybe it doesn't work.
I think I will hold off on making a recommendation at this point. Your input is certainly very meaningful to us, and as we go forward here, you know, at the end of the day, when all of this analysis is finished and we can conclude definitively what we have actually accomplished, at that point, I think we will be in a position to make a statement about design practices.
Yeah, I have one last question, and it has nothing to do with World Trade Center 7. It has to do with World Trade Center 4, 5, and 6. And I just have the understanding that the portions that were collapsed were the portions where the towers came down, and the rest of the portions, they did experience complete burnout with sagging of beams but not collapse. Is that true?
Actually, Charlie, this is Terry. I recall World Trade Center 5 had some interior failures. We noticed it because when we looked up, the roof was intact, but there was a section on the east side of the building where floor beams had failed at connections. They had T's sticking out from the columns, and the connections were made several feet away from the column so they could drop the beams in. And those had failed in a number of places.
Okay.
You're right on 4 and 6. The damage there was due to the towers falling on top of them.
Okay.
Thank you, Charlie. Bob?
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. I don't have a specific question. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make. One is, I appreciate all the effort that NIST has done going through this, and based on the summaries that we heard, I'm quite pleased. On the other hand, there will be some questions that are coming up, and I'm looking forward to reading the documentation that supports that describes and supports what they've been doing over the last couple of years. It's going to be very important, and the conclusions that come out of it, as Charlie indicated, could have far-reaching effects, so we have to be very careful that we don't miss something of great import. That's essentially my comments.
Yeah, we agree with you wholeheartedly, Bob, and I think John Barsom probably also agrees with that comment wholeheartedly.
That's all I have, Paul.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Is there anything else from anyone?
Yeah, just one last comment, and again,
Charlie?
This is sort of thinking out. It seems to me that as a structural engineer designs longer and longer floor spans, we better be paying attention to the fire ratings.
You're damn right.
Well, I just have one question for you, Terry. The connections could be had a considerable impact on how this building performed. Can you talk to me a little bit about what the connections were and how they were fireproofed?
Well, there were two basic type of connections. One is a shear connection, where the connection was basically between the web of the beam to the column. And the connection was made either with a single plate or double angles, and then bolts and welds, and how they used the bolts and the welds either on the column or on the beam web identified three types of shear connections. And then the larger members, the girders, which often supported the beams, the floor beams, so they carried larger loads. When they framed into the columns, they had what we call a bearing seat connection. So there was a fairly substantial plate, either usually constructed to look like an angle or else supported off of the column that made a seat for the girder to sit on. And then additionally, they had some sort of what we call a clip, a lighter tie, either at the web or the top of the flange, mostly to provide lateral stability when the building was under construction rather than any real transfer of structural load once the building was functioning. And, of course, there's variations on those. If the girders did not frame orthogonally into the face of the column, then we had to consider the angles, and these particular geometries might also have a change in the sizing of different elements, and that would change the modes of failure or the loads at which failures might occur.
And how was what was the fireproofing on all those connections?
The drawings we received on the connections did not specify any information about fireproofing. So what we've been using in that regard, we have photographs of the building when it was under construction, and then just understanding of what standard practice is for applying the fireproofing material that was used in WTC 7.
Are you suggesting that there's no absolute concrete information as to whether fireproofing was actually applied or not?
No, I am not saying that. I'm saying if you're looking for specifications such as a certain thickness being applied to the beams, there is no specification for thickness applied to connections.
This is Charlie. I would assume that the average engineer would assume that it's the same as the thickness on the beam or the column.
Yes, that's sort of how it happens, and that's sort of how it is also, I think, done in the field. But Terry is right. The architect, you know, the architectural drawings don't really prescribe the fireproofing on the connections. In fact, that is one of the reasons why. And plus, we don't really know how connections behave in fire in terms of the E119 testing that is done.
True.
And so our recommendation that we had in the Towers report, which probably, you know, we have to look at also in the context of this report, is how actually connections perform in fires.
Actually, Sean, that's where I was going with this, but I think you do have to address that issue.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else from anyone? Well, hearing nothing, I want to thank you, Terry, for your usual excellent report, and we look forward to finding out more as time goes on.
Very good, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the discussion of the our annual report to Congress that we are obliged to produce. You have in front of you the copy that I sent out with Bob Hansen's suggested editorial comments. I personally have no problem with any of them and would move that we accept the comments as they exist as our working document.
I agree.
Oh, I have one more editorial thing.
Oh, God, Bob, what do you have?
Sorry for being so picky.
Oh, wait till I start.
Steve picked up all my comments, and I found one more going through your revision. At the end of paragraph 2?
Yes.
It says code bodies during?
Paragraph 2. Okay.
Code bodies during?
Oh, yes.
I don't think during belongs there.
No, I don't believe it does. And that's one I didn't see.
Or add during those meetings, which is what I had done.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. I will add that in if everybody's agreed to it. I hear no disagreement, so I'll accept that as agreement. Any other comments?
My only comment, Paul, this is Dave Collins. At the end of the report, I actually had suggested some language that I think World Trade Center 7 is likely, the report is likely to have even greater impact than we saw from the initial study reports because of the causal association with more normal circumstances within a building other than being hit by an airplane.
Actually, I agree with you, Dave. I did not put anything like that in there, but I'm certainly open to the idea of mentioning that. How does other committee members feel about that?
okay with me.
Well, you could. We believe that a similar or greater impact. Would you like to say that?
I changed it to say we believe an even larger impact will result once World Trade Center 7 investigation is completed and the code change is developed to present to the code bodies.
Bob?
I guess my concern is not having the result. It's sort of hard to anticipate.
Yeah, I think it's better to say a similar or greater impact.
Well, my only comment was that the direction that we're headed with the report, I think there was and continues to be concern within many in the industries that events of 1 and 2 were caused by an airplane impact, and therefore the results aren't as directly tied to what we see in typical buildings, whereas 7 is obviously not that kind of event. So I think it will perhaps have the opportunity at least more directly impact what we do on a day-to-day in design and construction as opposed to a special kind of event that 1 and 2 were related to.
I don't have a strong feeling if replacing similar by greater, that's no big deal to me.
Charlie?
I'm fine.
So we'll take out similar and put in greater.
Fine.
Okay. Just for the record, there were a few editorial comments I received from Matt and a couple I found. Many of them happened to be with capitalization, minor stuff, but there is one thing I would change, and it happens to be in the third paragraph in the last sentence. I see I use the word future twice in the same sentence, and I'd like to drop the first one and put in the word committee instead, so the sentence reads, committee membership can then be determined by the technical expertise required by any future NCSD investigations.
I agree.
And because I always get these things wrong, in the next paragraph down, second line, it says, in affecting construction changes, and Matt kindly pointed out that I made a grammatical error there. It should be in affecting construction changes. Other than that, there are some changes of capitalization, like a capital R for recommendations, which should be lowercase.
Do you want to change an A to an E? Is that it?
Basically, yes.
Either way.
I'll let the English people decide.
No, the meanings are different, you know. Either it has an influence on or it brings about. I mean, you want to say it brings about construction changes or it has an influence on construction changes? What do you want to say?
Effecting is certainly the stronger word. I prefer affecting.
I can't hear the difference between the A and the E, the one you say it.
I apologize for that. In Boston, there is no difference.
You tell that, Paul.
So if there's no objections, I will make that change.
Fine.
Okay. Fine. With that, I'd accept a motion that we accept the report as amended during this meeting.
We'll move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much, gentlemen. That concludes the committee active portion of the meeting. We are running about 10 minutes behind. I would suggest that we take a 10-minute break and come back at 2:45 for our public comment period.
So do we hang up and call back in?
Either Paul? That or put your line on
Paul?
Mute. I'm just going to mute my line.
Well,
I need to sign
Paul,
off.
Can we cut this break for just 5 minutes, if you don't mind?
No, I don't mind. If everybody's ready to roll, 2:40.
Yeah. Yeah, let's try 240.
Okay.
All right, I'm signing off.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, tell them.
This is the time for the three public speakers or public commenters. If you would please call in. And as soon as we resume, Mr. Fitzgerald will call you in order, and he will give you your 5 minutes to speak. He will notify you when you have 1 minute left to speak in your 5 minute allotted time.
Paul, if you're on the line, then
I am live.
If there's enough quorum, then I think we can start.
Okay. Has everybody signed in, Sham? I just came back on.
Paul, we have Richard Gage.
Mr. Gage and Mr. Gourley.
And Mr. Gourley on the line.
And we haven't heard from Mr. Leapad yet.
Not yet, no. But you should probably go around and make sure that we have everybody from the committee back on the line.
Yes. I've heard Charlie. Bob?
This is Jerry Leapart.
Okay, we have all three of our speakers here. Mr. Leapart, we're just going to go around and make sure that we have the committee members here.
Very well, thank you.
Bob? Dave?
Yes.
Charlie?
Yep.
Foreman?
I'm here.
So the only one not here is Bob, and he, I thought he said he might have to leave early. Am I right on that, Steve?
That's correct.
You have a quorum of four people.
We have a quorum. Fine. Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen, and welcome to the committee meeting. As you know, each of you will be allowed 5 minutes to provide your comments to the committee and to the NIST staff. And about to help you with your timing, with about a minute to go on the in that five-minute interval, I will just make a comment that you have approximately 1 minute left. At that time, you should begin to summarize your comments and finalize any recommendations you want to make to the committee or to NIST. We'll go in the order of starting with Mr. Gage, followed by Mr. Gourley, and finally by Mr. Leapart. There will be no questions can be directed to the committee during this point in time or to NIST staff. This is your opportunity to speak to us. And with that, I would like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Richard Gage, an architect who represents the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Mr. Gage, it's all yours.
I'm Richard Gage, AIA, a licensed architect of 20 years. I represent the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which is a fast-growing body of 230 architects and engineers dedicated solely to bringing out the truth of all three high-rise building collapses on 9/11. We believe that we might have some answers to your questions. In over 100 steel frame high-rise fires, most of them very hot, very large, and very long-lasting, not one has collapsed, ever. So it behooves all of us, as your own former chief of NIST's Fire Science Division, Dr. James Quintier, said, to look at real alternatives that might have been the cause of these collapses. Let's start with temperatures. 1,340 degree temperatures recorded by the thermal images on the top of the surface of the World Trade Center pile a week after 9/11 by NASA's Avarice equipment on the USGS flights over the ruins. Such temperatures cannot be achieved by an oxygen-starved hydrocarbon fire. Those burn only 400 to 600 degrees Fahrenheit. Remember, there's no fire on top of the pile. The source of this massive heat was below the rubble, far hotter than 1,340 degrees. Let's look at what Mark Loiseau, president of Controlled Demolition, who was hired for Building 7 cleanup. Literally molten steel was discovered more than a month after the rubble was being removed. Leslie Robertson, World Trade Center structural engineer, stated on October 5th, 21 days after the attack, the fires were still burning and molten steel was still running. fire department personnel are recorded on video from New York. Molten steel still running down the channels, flowing like lava from a volcano. Joe O'Toole, a Bronx firefighter, saw a crane lifting a steel beam vertically from deep within a pile. He said it was dripping from the molten steel. Now, all of this is specifically denied by your lead engineer, John Gross, in his appearance at the University of Texas this year. But now, where this steel only begins to melt at about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is over three times the temperature of the World Trade Center fires. What melted the steel? Let's take a look at FEMA's Appendix C. The BPAT report documents the beam ends showing rapid oxidation, sulfidation, and intergranular melting, a liquid eutectic mixture from sulfur of unknown source causing intense corrosion on the steel, gaping holes in wide flange beams, and the thinning of one-half-inch thick flanges to almost razor sharpness in the World Trade Center 7 steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Yet NIST left all of this crucial forensic evidence out of their report. Last year, though, Dr. Stephen Jones, a physicist and two other physicists and a geologist, analyzed the slag at the ends of the beams and in the samples of the previously molten metal, finding molten iron, aluminum, sulfur, manganese, and fluorine, the chemical evidence of thermate, a high-tech incendiary cutter charge used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. The byproduct of thermite is molten iron. There's no other possible source for all the molten iron. One of thermite's key ingredients is sulfur, which can form a liquid eutectic and lower the melting point of steel. Now, World Trade Center 7's catastrophic structural failure showed every characteristic of explosive controlled demolition. You can see all this at our website, ae911truth.org. Rapid onset of destruction at the base of the building. The first responders witnessed explosions about a second prior to the collapse. We have a symmetrical near free fall speed of collapse through the path of greatest resistance, the 40,000 tons of steel designed to resist this load, straight down into its own footprint. Now, this requires that all the columns have to fail within a fraction of a second of each other. That's perimeter as well as core columns.
Fire
cannot do this. Fire produces large, gradual deformations and asymmetrical collapses, but thermite can with linear-shaped charges. We also have mistimed explosions that you can see on our website at the upper seven floors on the network video recordings. Now, how long must we endure NIST's cover-up of the truth of Building 7's destruction? Millions of Americans, including the 230 architects and engineers and 600 others of AE911truth.org, demand that NIST come clean with a full-throttled, fully resourced, and transparent forensic investigation of the prima facie evidence of the controlled demolition of Building 7.
Thank you, Mr. Gage. Our next speaker is Mr. Gourley, an attorney who represents several scientists and 9/11 victims' families. Mr. Gourley, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak, but I should clarify that although I do represent some 9/11 victims' family members and several scientists, including Mr. Gage, in a request for correction under the Data Quality Act, that's still pending before NIST. I'm appearing here today just as a member of the public and on behalf of the public. But with that, I would also like to just say I concur with basically everything Richard just said, although I wouldn't jump to quite the conclusion he did, because you still have an opportunity to issue your final report that does tell the truth. So, and in that final report, as we've pointed out in our request for correction with regards to the World Trade Center towers, you have some obligations under the Data Quality Act, and those obligations included the following. Anything you release must have integrity, and that means that it should be safeguarded from improper access, modification, or destruction. And it also must be objective, meaning that it must be accurate, reliable, and unbiased, and it must be presented in a clear and complete and unbiased manner. And with specific regard to this report, which you guys have just been discussing a lot, is that this report is going to be highly influential. And under the Data Quality Act, influential scientific information is subject to even stricter standards. And those standards are that they generally require sufficient transparency about data and methods that an independent reanalysis could be undertaken by a qualified member of the public. Now, that was not done in the case of the World Trade Center towers, and I truly hope it will be done in the case of World Trade Center Building 7, especially given the import that you guys have just stated that the report will have. The second point I'd like to make is that I'm still a little bit unclear on whether you're actually going to take your analysis beyond the collapse initiation and carry it forward all the way through to where the building has completely and utterly destroyed itself at free fall speed. And if you are going to carry it to that point, I'm curious as to why you didn't do it for the World Trade Center towers. You know, there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there, why that would be required for one building but not the other two. And the third point I'd like to make is about these hypothetical blast scenarios. It's also curious, you say you found no evidence for any controlled demolition scenario, but yet you're running experiments that analyze hypothetical blast events. I'm very curious to how you're going to incorporate that into your report in some way other than to just discredit it completely without giving it any serious consideration. And the final point I'd like to make is that there were major mainstream media reports about the fire alarms inside Building 7 being turned off very early in the morning of 9/11. And I sincerely hope that some analysis of that will make it into your final report on Building 7. And that's all I have. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Gawley. Mr. Leapot?
Yes, thank you. My name is Jerry Leapart. I am an attorney. I also represent individuals who have presently pending requests for correction that are in various stages of processing, as well as individuals who have presently pending lawsuits relating to the preparation of NC Star 1 and together with the ongoing investigation of WTC-7. I concur for the most part with the comments made by the previous two speakers, which do serve in the main to place NIST on notice that the lengthy and often delayed report on what caused the destruction of World Trade Center 7 is a matter of extreme importance to the public. We're somewhat perplexed by the repeated delays in the preparation and going forward with that report. We note that in the commentary on the status of the report had today, it quite frankly does not appear as if very much progress has been made, and that the indications that certain parts of it will be ready for review as early as January, with a complete draft done as early as July of 2008, seem no more realistic than any of the prior time estimates for conclusion of that report. My particular comments will be supplemented with a mailing of the comments into NIST, as is permitted by the regulations governing today's session. Those comments will, in the main, focus on the issue of how the investigation is framed. The investigation is framed as determining why and how World Trade Center 7 building collapsed, but that is an incomplete statement. The World Trade Center 7 building collapsed or was destroyed in a manner that resulted in a heap, that is to say, a pile of rubble that did not even spread across the adjoining street. It was a trapezoidal building that self-destructed in a matter of 6.6 seconds and came down into that heap on a symmetrical basis. In addition, the remnants of that building included steel beams that were visibly transformed and virtually disintegrated. Accordingly, all of the discussion had today concerning temperature assumptions, concerning working hypotheses that have still, some 6 years later, not yet resulted in even a leading hypothesis, and small wonder, all serve to demonstrate that the investigation into what caused the destruction of World Trade Center 7 is seriously off target and amiss and should probably be halted pending a determination of why the status of that investigation can get no further than that of a working hypothesis, and this some 6 years later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leapot.
Paul, this is Steve Kaufman. If I could just ask our three presenters if they would be so kind as to submit their written comments to me so that they can be accurately reflected in the record, I would greatly appreciate that. Gentlemen, I believe you all have my email address.
Yes. Is that Stephen? Yeah,
yes.
I have yours. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, and I'd be happy to submit them.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you for your comments. We appreciated receiving them. That concludes the formal part of the agenda. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Hearing nothing, I will accept the motion for adjournment.
So moved.
So moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you all, and I wish you all a great holiday season. And I appreciate the participation of everybody in the meeting, and I look forward to our next get-together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you and your staff for everything, and it was very well done. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye.